It is time now to begin the reading of today's Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, October 21st, 2025. And we say hello, filling in this morning, to Ken.
Hello and welcome. In Monday's markets, Apple and trade thaw lift stocks toward new highs. Easing trade tensions and a big gain in Apple shares helped drive stocks back toward records at the start of a heavy week of corporate earnings. Indexes opened with gains, with some investors saying sentiment was buoyed by President Trump saying he will soon meet with China's leader Xi Jinping and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's Friday comments that he will meet with his Chinese counterpart in person this week. Also helping support stocks, Trump has exempted dozens of products, from gold and LED lights to chemicals, from his so-called reciprocal tariffs in recent weeks, and has said more such exemptions are in the works. Trump's reignition of the trade war with China earlier this month shattered a long stretch of market calm and sent the S&P 500 to its worst day since April on October 10th. Concerns about loan losses at regional banks added to investors' worries last week, but cooling tensions and solid earnings from some lenders have helped make markets rebound in recent sessions. This administration is clearly open to deal-making, and I think the market is leaning on that for now, said Ross Mayfield, investment strategist at Baird. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 516 points, or around 1.1%. The S&P 500 also gained 1.1%, while the NASDAQ Composite climbed 1.4%. All three now stand less than 0.3% from all-time highs. Apple shares offered a major boost, rising 3.9% to their first record close since December after a report that sales of this year's iPhone models had started strongly. The technology giant's market value hit $3.89 trillion, making the company the second largest in the U.S. by market cap after NVIDIA and ahead of Microsoft. Nearly one-fifth of S&P 500 companies are due to report results this week, including Netflix and Tesla. Cleveland-Cliffs stock jumped 21% after the steelmaker reported rising demand and said it would explore producing rare earth minerals. Companies reporting earnings on Tuesday include GE Aerospace, Coca-Cola, General Motors, and Ford Motor. Some investors may be buying stocks with the expectation that coming earnings reports could push up prices, said Jason Pride, Chief Investment Strategy and Research at Glenmead. There's a possibility that investors walked into Monday and decided that they don't want to be underexposed during earnings season, he said. Other good news for investors? National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett said the government shutdown could end this week, raising hopes that a long, economically damaging stoppage could be averted. In global markets, Japan's Nikkei 225 index rose 3.4% to a record after the country's ruling party agreed to a coalition deal. Hong Kong's Hang Seng index gained 2.4%, while the Stocks Europe 600 advanced 1%. And a couple articles from the Herd on the Street page. An ACA deal won't help insurers. A subsidy agreement to end the shutdown would calm nerves for now, but deeper issues remain. With the government shutdown entering its fourth week, Wall Street has been boosting bets that Republicans and Democrats will strike a deal. Shares of insurers operating in the Affordable Care Act exchanges surged in recent weeks. In effect, the investors are betting that enhanced subsidies for these plans will be extended. But even if that happens, some of these insurers still face structural problems that one policy reprieve won't fix. In the years leading up to Donald Trump's second presidency, Medicare Advantage plans were squeezed while Medicaid and ACA exchange plans benefited from pandemic-era rules that boosted enrollment and funding. The unwinding of that support, combined with Republican control of Congress and the White House, flipped the script. The outlook for Medicare Advantage may now be improving, but Medicaid and ACA exchange plans have suffered as enrollment declined and healthier members dropped out, leaving a costlier pool behind. At the same time, healthcare costs have accelerated more than insurance companies expected. This explains why Centrin and Molina healthcare shares were sharply lower this year, before partly rebounding in recent weeks. They both remain down 35% or more this year. Their rebound rally comes as Wall Street bets that the Biden-era enhanced subsidies for ACA plans, set to expire at year-end, could be renewed as part of a deal to end the shutdown. Democrats have made that a condition for reopening the government, and reports suggest Republicans are exploring ways to make an extension acceptable to their base. That is far better than what investors expected months ago when Republicans left the subsidy extensions out of President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill. A one-year renewal, pushing the issue past the 2026 midterms, would buy another year of stability for insurers, though the potential impact on soaring premiums for 2026 is unclear given that open enrollment starts on November 1st. The more bullish scenario would be a deal that narrows eligibility, say by age or income, but keeps subsidies for longer. That would shrink the market, but have only a modest impact on insurers like Centene, whose members skew lower income, said J.P. Morgan analyst John Stansel. Even with a long-term extension, these insurers could be swimming against the tide for years. Centene and Molina are deeply tied to two programs, Medicaid and the ACA exchanges, that face mounting structural headwinds. The biggest challenge is adverse selection, and efforts to curb ACA subsidies to higher-income cohorts could make it worse. Millions of healthier members fell off the rolls as pandemic-era protections expired, and millions more could lose eligibility for Medicaid under the One Big Beautiful Bill and its new work requirements. That leaves behind a sicker, costlier population. While Medicare Advantage appears to be emerging from its slump and could benefit from friendlier treatment under a Republican administration, there is no clear end in sight to margin pressure, especially for Medicaid plans. In theory, health insurance is a short-term business that can reprice annually to reflect higher costs. Regulations require Medicaid payment rates to be actuarially sound, meaning states can't simply pay insurers whatever they want. But states have leeway to use conservative assumptions, and rates often lack behind actual cost trends when budgets are tight. Molina and Centene recently sounded upbeat about recovering Medicaid margins, but United Health Group struck a more cautious tone, warning that it could take time for state payments to catch up to higher medical costs. We anticipate the existing rate and acuity mismatch will extend well into next year, United Health Care Chief Executive Tim Noel said on the company's last earnings call. Analysts at TD Cowen expect several years of medical cost pressures as states grapple with deficits and try to balance benefits with enrollment. In the ACA exchanges, insurers are seeking premium increases that can exceed 20% next year to protect margins, even if it means losing members. The companies say the big increases are needed because of higher health care costs and changing federal policy. Molina and Centene told investors that new rates should better reflect their members' higher medical needs, but there is no guarantee those price increases will offset the cost of sicker enrollees who are seeking more care than ever. A restoration of ACA subsidies could steady sentiment for now, because it would help offset the surging premiums by keeping plans affordable for millions of members through tax credits, but it won't fix the underlying pressure on these businesses overnight. Insurers in the ACA exchanges and Medicaid remain caught in a tough political and economic bind with no quick way out. Going fragrance-free is the right move for Kering. Under its old leadership, Kering was carrying too much debt in service of an overly ambitious strategy. A £4 billion check, equivalent to $4.66 billion, from the sale of its beauty division, puts those worries to rest. Shares of the French luxury company rose 4.8% in Paris on Monday after it said it was selling its beauty business, confirming a Wall Street Journal report over the weekend. The move signals that Kering won't seek to match the end-to-end scale of rival LVMH in fragrances and cosmetics, focusing instead on its core luxury brands such as Gucci and Bottega Veneta. Under the terms of the all-cash deal, L'Oreal will buy perfume brand Creed, which Kering purchased for 3.5 billion euros 2 years ago. L'Oreal gets a 50-year license to sell perfume and cosmetics for Kering's brands Bottega Veneta and Balenciaga, as well as the license for Gucci once a pre-existing agreement with Coty expires. If all of the proceeds from the L'Oreal deal are used to pay down debt, Kering's net borrowing will fall to 1.5 times 2026 earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, down from 2.5 times before the deal, based on Citi estimates. The level is more manageable for Kering, whose core business is performing badly at the moment. Gucci, which typically generates two-thirds of the company's operating profit, is in the doldrums. Kering's share price has halved over the past 4 years. The deal shows investors that Kering's new boss, Luca de Meo, who comes from the auto industry, is serious about repairing the company's balance sheet and doesn't mind revising decisions made by Kering's founders, the Pinault family. De Meo has already deferred plans to buy the remaining 70% of Valentino that Kering doesn't own. It also has been selling stakes in luxury properties in Paris and New York to raise cash. The plan was for Kering to use Creed as a foundation to build out a fragrance and makeup business, but the sale effectively ends that. Creed is very profitable and was one of the company's best performers in the second quarter, growing sales 12% compared with the same period of last year. But Kering overpaid for it in 2023. The 3.5 billion euro price tag represented 14 times sales, Bank of America estimates, a much higher premium than other beauty deals. Additionally, a niche brand like Creed doesn't yet have the infrastructure needed to build a serious global beauty business without heavy investment. The retail network for perfume and makeup is fragmented, so companies need scale to offset the high fixed cost of manufacturing and distribution, said Luca Solca, luxury analyst at Bernstein. LVMH, the world's largest luxury conglomerate, has a multi-billion dollar Christian Dior beauty business and can afford to run its own beauty operations in-house. It launched a range of $160 Louis Vuitton lipsticks in August and will keep a tight leash on manufacturing and distribution. Brands like Prada that don't have established beauty businesses usually opt for licensing agreements with global giants such as L'Oreal or Estee Lauder. Luxury companies want exposure to the category. The average selling price for perfume and cosmetics is lower than for clothing or handbags, which helps brands to attract a wide base of consumers. But Kering will get exposure to the business through the royalties it will collect from L'Oreal. Licensing agreements typically pay fees worth 6% to 8% of sales. Most important is that shedding its beauty ambitions will allow Kering to focus on what would really make it shine, nursing Gucci back to health. Your portfolio needs a vacation. Sometimes you dodge a bullet by going with your gut. Financial theory tells us that one of the few free lunches is having a diversified portfolio, which can produce similar returns to a more concentrated one with less choppiness. But investors around the world shortchange themselves through home country bias. Because of greater familiarity with their domestic stock market, they own too much relative to its weight in the world. That is an issue for a Swede or a Brazilian. It was an absolute nightmare for Japanese investors who only had eyes for their red-hot market in the 1980s. It took 34 years to break even after Japan's bubble burst. Diversification has been easier for Americans to ignore, and profitable, too. Over the past 15 years, U.S. stocks' total return has trounced the rest of the developed world by nearly 500 percentage points. Looking abroad has rarely been a better idea. U.S. stocks' valuations and the dollar look a lot like they have in the past when foreign stocks took the leadership baton. Since 1970, there have been six stretches when foreign developed country stocks vastly outperformed. A common retort is that U.S. companies like NVIDIA, Apple, and Microsoft are just better. A recent study by fund manager GMO mostly refutes that. About 80% of America's excess performance from 2010 through 2024 came from rising valuations and a stronger dollar, not corporate fundamentals. Both could reverse. U.S. tech stocks are so huge, though, that you might not be out of the woods by spreading bets across all developed markets. Eight tech titans alone make up more than a quarter of the MSCI World Index, which tracks 1,320 companies. You would have faced similar issues back in 1990 with Japanese banks. One radical way to avoid that is to own an equal weight version of the MSCI World. The U.S. makes up just 42% of it, with NVIDIA having the same weight as obscure Belgian widget makers. That index has performed atrociously, though, trailing even the plain vanilla MSCI World in each of the past 7 years, and such gimmicks really aren't necessary. Neither is a wholesale shift to a portfolio that hews exactly to America's one-quarter weight in the world economy to hedge their bets. Many big U.S. companies that aren't richly priced tech juggernauts earn much of their money abroad, and plenty of domestic index funds have lower exposure to the frothiest U.S. sectors, those that weight stocks by value or other measures, for example. Meanwhile, mixing in a smattering of foreign index exchange-traded funds has never been easier or cheaper. Dusting off your passport might become profitable, but there's no need to become a full-fledged expat to reap the benefits of a more balanced portfolio. U.S. banks are wary of joining Argentina bailout. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs is struggling to put together a $20 billion loan to Argentina without leaving themselves too exposed to the financially distressed South American country, people familiar with the matter said. The bank loans would be part of the Trump administration's plan to backstop the finances of Libertarian President Javier Milei's government with a $40 billion package, including a $20 billion currency swap with the U.S. Treasury Department and a separate $20 billion bank-led debt facility. The banks, which also include Citigroup, are seeking some type of guarantee or pledge to ensure they will get their money back, the people said. Bankers are waiting for guidance from the Treasury on what collateral Argentina would be able to provide for them, or if Washington would plan to backstop the facility on its own, the people said. While banks normally arrange these types of rescue facilities on their own, the Treasury has been controlling the broader package, and banks feel they can't act without backing from Washington, some of the people said. The loan facility hasn't been completed and might not come together if the bank's collateral question isn't resolved, they said. A Treasury spokesman said discussions on this facility remain ongoing, and we look forward to sharing more detail when these talks are complete. U.S. banks haven't been lending to Argentina, and the country has been shut out of the international capital markets for years. Successive governments have borrowed dollars or printed money rather than cutting spending to narrow chronic budget gaps that led to runaway inflation. Latin America's third largest economy has missed sovereign debt payments 9 times, with 3 so far since 2000. To fill the gap, the Argentine government has received more than 20 financial aid packages from the International Monetary Fund since the 1950s, including a facility agreed to earlier this year. But those bailouts have failed to prevent recurring financial market collapses, bank runs, and devastating devaluations, leading to political and social turmoil. Alongside the planned $20 billion from banks, the Treasury Department has also agreed to swap $20 billion for a roughly equivalent amount of Argentine pesos, meaning to boost Argentina's foreign currency reserves and help it protect the value of its currency. By law, the swap doesn't require Argentina to post collateral, and the value of the pesos is supposed to be near equal to the Treasury's investment. But the peso is steadily depreciating and could slide further if the government is forced by the IMF to allow the peso to freely float and have its price determined by market forces. In the past, countries, including Mexico, have pledged other assets to ensure U.S. taxpayers are protected in similar transactions. The risks from these operations are unusually large, said Brad Sester, who was a Deputy Assistant Treasury Secretary in the Obama administration. Should the peso depreciate, which many think is not only likely but necessary, the Treasury would be left holding assets that have fallen in value. Argentina's currency is down 30% against the dollar this year and depreciated further on Monday as Argentines braced for economic instability risks ahead of Sunday's midterm elections. The Treasury spokesman said the government was using tools that Treasury has available, which are quick and effective to stabilize Argentina, calling that a bridge to a better economic future for Argentina, not a bailout. He declined to specify what collateral, if any, was being used for the swap facility. Argentina's central bank declined to comment. Argentina may be able to pledge its own sovereign debt or future tax revenues against any of the bailout packages, but those are less than ideal situations. Argentina's sovereign bonds are worth far less than their face value, and pledging future tax revenue from Argentina's vast agricultural exports risks sparking political pushback in Argentina, where there are already widening concerns of U.S. meddling in domestic affairs. Any funding from private financial institutions would likely require some backing or collateral enhancement from the U.S. Treasury, market observers say. The U.S. facilities are also raising the possibility of a conflict between the IMF and the Treasury. The IMF has typically worked in partnership with the U.S. government, but the Treasury has designed its plan rescue largely on its own and without significant input from the fund on some key details, people familiar with the matter said. Argentina owes the IMF almost $60 billion, more than any other country in the world. On the sidelines of the IMF meetings in Washington, D.C. last week, officials from the fund said they were concerned that the Trump administration could pressure Argentina to put the U.S. liabilities ahead of the IMF's sizable loans, people familiar with the matter said. A spokesman for the IMF said the fund is determined to support Argentina in restoring economic stability and accelerate growth, working side by side with the Argentine authorities and the U.S. Treasury. The $20 billion currency swap comprises most of the funds available in the Treasury's rainy day facility, called the Exchange Stabilization Fund. In 1995, the Clinton administration provided Mexico with $20 billion in loans and credits secured by the country's oil exports, following the devastating tequila crisis sparked by the devaluation of the Mexican peso. That facility was repaid and the peso was allowed to float freely, becoming one of the most traded emerging market currencies. On Monday, Argentina's central bank said it agreed on terms and conditions for the $20 billion bilateral currency swap provided by the U.S. Treasury, without disclosing details. The peso gained on the news, but swung back into the red versus the dollar later. Dumpling craze turns chain into restaurant powerhouse. Every Saturday, Taiwanese restaurant chain Din Tai Fung plates as many as 20,000 of its delicate steamy dumplings, and that is just in Times Square. No one is cashing in on America's craze for dumplings more than the fast-growing Taiwanese restaurant group. After starting in the U.S. on the West Coast and relying on suburban shopping mall traffic, Din Tai Fung is now leaning into core downtown neighborhoods on the East Coast. Its Manhattan restaurant in Times Square is the chain's top-selling location in the U.S. Next up is Brooklyn. Din Tai Fung unveiled plans Monday to open a 20,000-square-foot downtown Brooklyn location. Chief Financial Officer Nilesh Patel said Brooklyn was the natural next step. It's diverse, it's creative, it's authentic, he said. The company's 16 restaurants in the U.S. generated an average of $27 million in annual sales last year, according to market research firm Technomic. That number is easily the highest among the 1,500 restaurant chains with five or more locations tracked by Technomic. Ridiculous numbers, said Keith Durst, owner of the hospitality advisory firm Friend of Chef. We're talking about unbelievably busy restaurants. Din Tai Fung opened two additional restaurants in the past year, in Santa Monica, California, and in Vancouver. The Cheesecake Factory, by contrast, sold an average of $12.4 million per location in 2024, while the steakhouse chain Del Frisco's Double Eagle Steakhouse averaged $13.8 million. Din Tai Fung has a simple playbook for success. Large footprints of 15,000 or more square feet, rapid service, and a never-ending production of hand-folded soup dumplings. Even though lines quay up outside the door at many Din Tai Fung locations, I've never had slow service, said Andrew Skogdahl, a real estate executive in the Seattle area who is friendly with one of Din Tai Fung's owners. At the bustling Times Square location, Din Tai Fung chefs on display behind glass walls mold the 18-fold standard to the chain's soup dumplings. A small robot ferries takeout orders between the kitchen and the pickup station. Placards on the table provide instructions on how to eat Din Tai Fung's Xiao Long Bao, or soup dumplings, and diners mark their orders on long slips of paper that are then collected by servers. I'm a big foodie, and it was spot on, said Amaryllis Avliar, a New Jersey resident who ate lunch at Din Tai Fung with two co-workers. The group spent about $320 on the meal, including green beans, ribs, fried rice, shrimp dumplings, dessert dumplings, and drinks. The company's American expansion coincides with a growing Asian population in the U.S. Asians have the highest levels of disposable income of any minority group in the country and spend the most money eating out, said Naveen Jaggi, president of retail advisory services at real estate firm JLL. Din Tai Fung is a family business that sold its first dumpling in Taipei in 1972 and now numbers more than 165 locations worldwide. It opened its first U.S. restaurant in 2000 in Arcadia, California, and has since expanded slowly across the state and Pacific Northwest. More than half of Din Tai Fung's locations are in malls, which the chain has sought out for the ample parking, exposure to new customers, and entertainment they provide while diners wait for a table. The malls benefit, too. An analysis by data firm Placer AI found that evening visits and the amount of time customers spend at the Santa Monica Place Mall in California increased after Din Tai Fung opened there. In Brooklyn, Din Tai Fung plans to open in 2027 on the ground floor of The Brook, a luxury apartment building where rent for a studio starts at $3,875 a month. The company is looking to continue expanding across the tri-state area and in top 10 markets across the country. Planned openings are already announced for the Fashion Square Mall in Scottsdale, Arizona, and the Irvine Spectrum Center and Brea Mall in California. We're definitely growing, Patel said. Amazon cloud outage disrupts internet. Apps and online services used by millions go down after botched update. A glitch in an obscure Amazon database disrupted life for millions of people across the U.S. as core internet services failed to function for an array of companies. Alexa devices went deaf. Corporate Slack messages wouldn't post. Students couldn't turn in assignments or access materials from courses. Financial trades were impossible on certain platforms. Users of Zoom, Venmo, Instacart, and a host of other services faced prolonged outages that rippled through homes and businesses. The trouble started a few hours after midnight on the East Coast on Monday. A minor update to what's called the domain name system, the kind of software tweak that happens millions of times a day on the internet, sent the well-oiled machine that underpins the modern web careening towards a crash. DNS acts as a kind of telephone directory for the internet, instructing machines on how to find each other. The faulty update gave the wrong information for DynamoDB, an Amazon Web Services product that has become one of the world's most important databases. Suddenly, machines on the East Coast that tried to process trillions of requests were getting the internet's equivalent of a wrong number. Amazon services were some of the first to feel the effects. At around 2 a.m., the system that helps Amazon sort packages onto trucks and guide drivers on the road went down, according to an internal message viewed by the Wall Street Journal. By 3 a.m., the outage's blast radius spread far beyond Amazon, cascading across the internet, delaying more than 4,000 flights, knocking out news websites such as the Wall Street Journal, affecting financial transactions, and extending into everyday life. The episode, which turned into one of the most prolonged daily outages for Amazon Web Services, offered a reminder of the fragility of global connectivity, which has gone dark a number of times in recent years after seemingly minor software updates. By late afternoon Monday, Amazon said it had restored much of the service that had been knocked offline. Even if just briefly, major providers like AWS going down represent vulnerabilities in what have become critical infrastructure for organizations and, in some cases, governments globally, said Jacob Born, an analyst at research firm eMarketer. As cloud reliance and workloads expand, these outages could hit industries harder. Another major outage for AWS in 2021 similarly disrupted businesses and personal activities across the economy for most of a day. Amazon controls about a third of the public cloud computing market, the core infrastructure of the modern internet. By the end of Monday, 142 AWS products were affected, including the software the company uses to spread computing demand over its sprawling network of data centers and the content delivery software it uses to display websites to internet browsers. So many East Coast services were affected that customers who wanted to simply pull up and move their computing operations to another part of Amazon's cloud found themselves unable to migrate. At 4 a.m. Eastern Time, the cryptocurrency exchange Coinbase told customers it was aware that many of them couldn't get into their accounts due to the outage and was working to get them back into their accounts. Some customers said that the outage left them unable to close their trades. A crypto exchange brought down by a centralized cloud. You can't preach decentralization and still depend on AWS to stay online, wrote one. Around the same time, the trading platform Robinhood also said that the AWS outage had knocked it offline. On X, the company said that issues persisted through the day, but were ultimately resolved. While it is too soon to have a complete understanding of the cost of the outage, other companies have faced multi-million-dollar claims and lawsuits when their services were at the root of global disruptions. On Monday, when Will Malden tried to print shipping labels for the weekend orders at his woodworking company in Rockville, Maryland, he couldn't log into the fulfillment system run by a third-party software provider. Later in the day, Malden discovered that he couldn't send coupons to new customers due to downtime at another vendor. "We're not getting our orders today, and we're not getting anything out," he said. "I had no idea that the loss of one web cloud service would chip away at my small business and give me a Monday morning from hell." Carlos Nudon, chief executive of Ponce Bank, said he couldn't charge his electric vehicle on Monday morning as the charging network uses AWS. Ponce, a New York-based bank, doesn't rely on the cloud for core banking services, but the outage delayed transactions and cost an estimated $50,000 to $100,000, he said. "Honestly, it's more unsettling than anything else," Nudon said. "You can't assume that something like this is going to be foolproof and nothing can happen. The Amazon Web Service outage is poised to accelerate a push among many executives to diversify their cloud services," analysts said. "Doing so can make it easier to respond and adjust to disruptions. But software executives cautioned that problems can occur on other major cloud platforms as well. Over the past decade, DynamoDB has come to power not only Amazon's massive retail operation, but increasingly to store data used by AWS computing services themselves, according to Adrian Cockcroft, a former AWS executive who is now a technology advisor. "But if you can't reach it because the DNS is down, then all sorts of things are not working," he said. Restaurants are pitching water as a fine dining experience. Menus highlight provenance and traits like acidity and minerality. No ice allowed. Magdalena Cayley was browsing the drinks menu at a Michelin-starred restaurant, wondering what might pair well with the $175 steak she planned to share with three friends. The server recommends something smooth and full-bodied. It was an $11 bottle of still water from the East Coast. Unlike most people who are drawn to high-end restaurants for the food, Cayley went to Gwen over the summer specifically to check out the Los Angeles Hotspot's water menu, part of a small but growing contingent interested in the rarefied world of fine water. She started with Saratoga, the East Coast water, before moving on to her French favorite, Evian. "I am absolutely obsessed with the taste and texture," the 38-year-old said. Cayley also tried a $12 Georgian sparkling water, Borjomi described on the menu as salty and complex. The salinity, she said, helped highlight the differences between the various waters she tried. It was fascinating to see that the water with the lighter mineral content paired nicely with our appetizers, she said. Gwen's Water Menu, a detailed book with lengthy descriptions of each water's origin and flavor profile, includes bottles from as far away as Australia and Armenia. Most cost between $11 and $13. It also offers tap water priced at $0. Martin Rees, the water sommelier behind Gwen's Menu, said the restaurant makes as much as $100,000 a year in water sales. H2O is the stuff of life, but for several decades, water producers and sommeliers have been working to make it something more, the stuff of taste. Rees and fellow water sommelier Michael Moska, founder of Fine Waters, a water connoisseur platform, began training people in their field in 2006. By 2018, they were educating hundreds worldwide. No one would think it strange if you served different types of vodka at a bar, said Rees. So why should it be any different for water? Plenty of people don't seem to be buying it. The idea has been slow to catch on more broadly. Some early adopters of the water menu were unsuccessful. It was hard not to laugh at it, said Jessica Hammerman, 48. She said of Gwen's Water Menu, the history professor and editor from Bend, Oregon, stuck to tap water during a visit there to celebrate her anniversary with her husband. She splurged instead on wine. The world's largest water menu can be found at Olar Doliention, a restaurant in Galicia, Spain, which offers more than 150 waters from 33 countries. Eateries in Italy, Denmark, and the UK offer their own aqua explorations. Around 10 restaurants in the US now offer a water menu. Industry experts say more could be on the way. Christopher Alexander would be happy to see more offerings. I'd argue it's the most important drink on the planet, he said. Gwen is currently his favorite restaurant in Hollywood, while the 26-year-old housing specialist from Long Beach, California, sometimes takes the server's recommendations, he usually ends up drinking Antipodes, one of the restaurant's most popular waters. Sourced from deep-pressured aquifers in New Zealand, it's smooth and easy to swallow, Alexander said. Not all waters are created equal. The difference, Rees said, usually comes down to the total dissolved solids, the mineral composition that determines a water's flavor profile based on its sodium, magnesium, and calcium content. Water with a high TDS is often bitter and acidic, making it a natural pairing for heavy, fatty foods. Water with lower TDS, considered dry in the mouth, pairs better with lighter fare, like salad or fish. Rees instructs servers to treat the waters like a fine wine. No ice or lemon allowed. Nothing that could dull the delicate flavor profile. The dining room at the inn at Little Washington in Virginia is one of the latest in the U.S. to offer fine water. Its menu, launched this spring, includes Berg water from Newfoundland, Canada, sourced from a 15,000-year-old iceberg. The light-bodied, low-mineral water costs $95 a bottle. The menu says it tastes of ancient packed snow and air. Water sommelier Cameroon Smith said many guests have never had a choice in the water they drink beyond the standard still, sparkling, or tap. It would be like a sommelier offering only red, white, or sparkling wine. Far too limited. The fraudster behind Ballmer's NBA nightmare. Joe Sandberg's bank got the Clippers owner to invest, then struck a puzzling deal with the team's star player. Los Angeles entrepreneur and progressive activist Joe Sandberg was in trouble. His online bank, Aspiration, had attracted buzz, and A-list investors like Robert Downey Jr. and Leonardo DiCaprio with its eco-friendly pitch. But by 2022, it was running out of money. Sandberg had begun falsifying financial documents and concocting phony customers in a scheme he would later admit defrauded investors of more than $248 million. His dream of springboarding into politics with an anti-poverty message was fizzling, too. A $10 million campaign to raise California's minimum wage, part of a plan to propel him to the governor's mansion or maybe even the White House, was heading for defeat. As the pressure mounted, though, Sandberg fixated on closing a deal that bewildered some colleagues. A $48 million endorsement contract between his struggling bank and Cowie Leonard, an NBA star considered one of the less charismatic members of LA's less glamorous franchise, the Clippers. "Makes no business sense whatsoever," a senior Aspiration executive texted Mike Shuckrow, the company's general counsel and chief operating officer, after learning of the proposed deal with Leonard, who was riding the bench that season while recovering from an ACL injury. Sandberg pushed through the deal anyway. "Now that contract is at the center of one of the biggest financial controversies in recent sports history. Leonard performed no significant work for the endorsement money, and the NBA has commissioned an investigation into whether the Clippers' billionaire owner, Steve Ballmer, a former Microsoft CEO and prized Aspiration investor, used the company to evade league salary cap rules and pay Leonard through another channel. The Clippers have denied breaking any rules. Several former senior executives of the bank said in interviews they never heard such a plan discussed. The notion that Steve invested in Aspiration in order to funnel money to Kawhi Leonard is absurd," the team said in a written statement. In the basketball world, the controversy has centered on the potential involvement of Ballmer, long seen as a model owner. Far less attention has been paid to how the activities of the little-known Sandberg, a 46-year-old from the wrong side of Orange County who got rich in venture capital but aspired to remake himself as a do-gooder, have put one of the world's wealthiest men in the crosshairs of an NBA investigation. On Monday, Sandberg appeared in a federal courtroom in L.A. to plead guilty to two counts of wire fraud in what prosecutors describe as a scheme to defraud hundreds of Aspiration investors. On Wednesday, Ballmer's team will take the basketball courts in Salt Lake City to open their 2025 season. Sandberg's lawyer, Mark McCossey, told the judge his client had committed his crimes because he loved his bank and wanted it to do well. Outside the courtroom, McCassey declined to answer questions about the Leonard contract. Star Investors. Sandberg co-founded Aspiration in 2013. The bank billed itself as the financial firm with a conscience. It offered traditional services like other retail banks. It also offered fossil fuel-free investments, donated 10% of earnings to charity, and let customers round up to the next dollar on bank card transactions to fund tree planting. That pitch attracted a host of celebrity investors: DiCaprio, Downey, Orlando Bloom, Cindy Crawford, Kia Gerber, and the musician Drake. Sandberg wasn't an Aspiration employee, but he served on its board and acted as a rainmaker. In meetings with the prospective investors, Sandberg ticked off the names of his Hollywood investors. Ballmer may have been the most important name of all. In 2021, he invested $50 million in the company. Weeks later, Sandberg announced a partnership that made the Clippers one of the most important customers of a new carbon credit business launched by the bank. The Clippers planned to put an Aspiration patch on its jerseys, and there were discussions about putting the bank's name on a new arena. "There are few people in the business world and in the sports world that I admire as much as Steve Ballmer," Sandberg said in the September 2021 announcement at the Clippers Arena as Ballmer looked on. Aspirations seemed to be on a roll. A plan to take it public would have valued the company at $2.3 billion and put Sandberg, its largest shareholder, on track to become a rare type of billionaire, a bleeding-heart liberal who listed his occupation as anti-poverty advocate. But things weren't what they seemed. In a plea agreement, Sandberg struck this August with federal prosecutors, he admitted that starting in 2020, his efforts to support the company turned fraudulent. He borrowed $145 million to aid the company using his own stock as collateral and furnished fraudulent financial statements to lenders to guarantee the transaction, the plea agreement said. Federal prosecutors haven't accused Aspiration employees of involvement in the fraud. Sandberg also recruited friends and associates to present themselves as potential customers for the carbon credit business. Pledges they submitted to unwitting company officials gave a false impression of explosive growth, allowing him to raise more than $300 million from misled investors, according to a separate Securities and Exchange Commission complaint against Sandberg. The SEC complaint indicates that most of the bank's $216 million revenue in 2022 was unconnected to the fraud. Sandberg's associates said in interviews that they believed he was trying to keep Aspiration solvent until a public offering or other infusion of funds. In the basketball world, Ballmer is celebrated for rescuing the Clippers from the messy end to the previous ownership regime, and for pouring his wealth into the roster and a new arena. He had an interest in fighting climate change and wanted the new facility to be carbon neutral. His $50 million investment in Aspiration gave Sandberg an invaluable boost. Jay Rogers, the CEO of a family office contemplating a business partnership with Aspiration, recalled sitting up at the mention of Ballmer's name. It was like, okay, this is real, Rogers said. Sandberg frequently referred to Ballmer as a powerful ally, according to several people who know him through political circles. Sandberg regularly attended Clippers games, sitting courtside. He told one political associate that Ballmer had told him that he reminded the billionaire of a younger version of himself. The associate recalled Sandberg saying that he and Ballmer were becoming friends. A person close to the Ballmer Group, his investment company, said the two hardly knew each other. He said that Ballmer and Sandberg had their first significant interaction at the press conference announcing the partnership between the Clippers and Aspiration. Success story. Sandberg grew up in Villa Park, an inland neighborhood of Orange County, far from the mansions of Newport Beach. His single mom struggled to make ends meet and eventually lost the family home to foreclosure. A stellar student, Sandberg graduated from Harvard and then went into finance. After a stint at Blackstone, he hit it big as a founding investor in the meal kit company Blue Apron. Sandberg never passed up an opportunity to tell others about growing up, as he once said on MSNBC, in a paycheck-to-paycheck household. In investor pitches and interviews, he said the desire to help people like his mother led him to co-found an environmental bank and get involved in politics. By 2020, Sandberg was flirting with a presidential run, explaining to a reporter during an exploratory trip to Iowa, "I would uniquely talk about poverty." When Bernie Sanders dropped out of the 2020 presidential race, Sandberg snapped up at least four of his advisors as political consultants. He and his advisors pursued a 2022 ballot measure to raise California's minimum wage to $18 an hour. He threw in $10 million, not including the cost of consultants, but failed to meet the deadline to get the issue on the ballot. In December 2021, Sandberg told a high-ranking Aspiration executive that the Clippers had approached him about doing a deal with Leonard, their injured star. The executive recalled Sandberg saying, "This is important to the Clippers." Aspiration executives learned that Sandberg was advocating for a four-year, $48 million deal with Leonard. Sandberg didn't control such agreements, but as the largest stockholder and a board member, his preferences carried weight. Inside the company, jaws dropped at the terms, with one executive telling a colleague that Aspiration could purchase 7 Super Bowl ads for the contract price. "If you want a talent deal, maybe we should shop around. Do some research. Consider a different team," one top executive told Shuckrow, the general counsel, in a text message reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. "You can't just commit to a $48 million spend without talking to people in the company. I don't get it." And that's it for today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center, and I thank you for listening.